Can you smell that?
Yes.
That is the smell of sausage and peppers wafting around New York City. Yes, we're gearing up for the Feast of San Gennaro, one of my favorite times living in New York City here. I love it. Ah, unbelievable. Feast of San Gennaro, always this time of the year. And it just is one of those times you just embrace being a New Yorker. Yes, sausage and peppers, Zeppelis. It's unbelievable. Little Italy gets over about a million people. A million people in this little tiny area called Little Italy. It's great. It's full of characters. If you've never been to it, you have to make your way to New York City. And if you're here, you certainly got to go between now and Sunday for it. Just for the smell alone. The food is divine. It is crowded. It is really, really crowded, but it is worth it. My name is Mark Farrell. Welcome to Insight on PRN.FM. Every Thursday, we broadcast right here from 11 till noon and always taking your phone calls at 888-874-4888. Yeah, Little Italy, one of my favorite places to go. Big weekend around here, eve of 9/11. NFL kicking off its 95th season today. Tonight, which is always a lot of fun, Thursday night games. A lot of anniversaries besides 9/11. Yours truly is going to talk about a fairly big anniversary. And we're going to have a doctor on from the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention talking about National Suicide Prevention Week as one of the umbrellas of which we're talking about, but the overall mental health picture in the United States, what they're doing, what they've done, to change this epidemic, because I've been touched by suicide. My brother took his life in 1992. I myself went through a lot of struggles and battles, but here I am thriving as we all chug through another day, right, and try to keep our heads up and smiling and all that jazz, which is sometimes hard to do. So my son came home the other day from his second day of first grade, and he was asking me what Patriot Day is and why do they wear red, white, and blue, and what 9/11 was about. And I'm really happy that this is being taught to students, especially in first grade. But of course, you have to choose your words really delicately because, for the obvious, I mean, you know, thousands of people were killed that day as an act of terrorism. So, you know, it's a pivotal day. It changed the lives of, I'd say, millions of people because out of those thousands of people touched, everyone knew somebody, safe to say, in this area and internationally, because there are so many different investment banks, et cetera, people who worked from, came over here from other countries. So it was an international incident, certainly the different locations in Virginia. But it was a life-changing event, and I myself lost a dear friend of mine, Harry Blanding, who was an incredible guy, went to college with him, a smile that it was just a perpetual smile, a great guy. I mean, this is how great he was, that apparently this came from a coworker that informed his wife this. I don't know why he would ever, or she, tell his wife this, but apparently Harry was on his way out of the building. He got into an elevator. And his boss said, Harry, come back. I need your help. So Harry would be here today, and I wouldn't be. And more importantly, his wife and three kids wouldn't be without a father. So Harry, being the, you know, huge-hearted person that he is, very much a giver, got off the elevator. Unsuspecting, of course, none of us suspected of the more or less major tragic circumstances that were unveiling and happening by the hour, half hour. And Harry didn't make it out. Freedom Tower has been built. It's occupied, open for business. At first, I was really kind of freaked out about it. It is a beautiful structure. But I see past that. It doesn't represent the same thing to me. And maybe that's not their plan. The Twin Towers were so significant to me and to millions of people and international, to our international listeners, tourists. But I remember standing on the One World Trade Center because our former radio station, CD 101.9 WRXP, 1019 Iraq Experience, broadcasted from there. The tower was there. And so the one time I went out there on the roof, it was very, very cool. This is probably about 1995-ish. You have to get special passes. They buzz you up when you're on the, I think, the 110th floor, 109th floor. And you get out to the roof. I was with the chief engineer of the radio station at the time. And there was a gentleman who perished, unfortunately, an Italian immigrant, who was the sole window washer. He actually drove or operated this manual, this very sophisticated, I should say, system that actually cleaned the windows automatically. It's almost like a car that rode around the inside track of the top of each building. And he was like, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. Mark, come on over here. You want to look out the side? I'm like, yeah, sure. I'm not afraid of heights. So I look out. I actually step out over the edge. I kid you not, over the edge of the Trade Center on this like metal catwalk that's affixed to this machine that goes down to clean the windows. And I looked down. I almost lost my breath, but I was like, could not fathom how tall it was. What an amazing structure. And then to put the it really in perspective, a helicopter went beneath us. I was like, whoa, this is really high. He's like, do you want to go down for a ride? I said, no grazie. No, I'm going to pass. But the tower had a lot of different meanings to a lot of different people. Of course, that's sacred ground. And it's commemorated by many different ways. I mean, people tomorrow will take off. Downtown has a different vibe. Manhattan itself has a different vibe. It's a sense of ambivalence, I think, that day, because people don't know really what to do. People have a different look on their face. People sound differently. Some people who didn't work here then, I think, don't really get the full impact. And that's a generalization. But having worked here that day, about a mile and change north of the Trade Center, watched the whole thing unfold. As a matter of fact, I was waiting for my friend Harry to come up because everyone was making an exodus north when this unfolded. So I spoke to his wife. I'm like, hey, Debbie, when Harry, you know, if you speak to Harry, tell him to come to the radio station. He can hang out with me. You know, we'll get lunch, et cetera. You know, not knowing that is a devastating and a day of doom. So I went out to lunch, actually, stepped outside. This is before the building collapsed, and or stepped out for coffee or something. And I said, hey, if my friend pops in, just tell him to hang out at my studio, et cetera. And, of course, Harry didn't show up. Buildings collapsed. And what we thought was, you know, going to be something not nearly as gargantuan as the outcome was unfolded to be that way. It changed everyone personally, and it changed me professionally as well, because that day I didn't leave the radio station for 2 days. I slept there. I lived right across the river at the time, but you know, a lot of people could not get into the radio station to fulfill shifts. So I gladly worked midnight to, I don't know, 6 a.m., 5 a.m. on the air broadcasting. And that was my privilege, to be able to dole out information to anyone listening. And that actually reminds me of the first time I actually went out. It's probably about noon or 1 o'clock. I left the radio station. I'm like, well, there's nothing I can do right now. So let me go to St. Vincent's Hospital, a few blocks away, and donate some blood. Because, I mean, obviously they're going to be in need of a great deal of blood. So I went over there, and they said they're not accepting blood. There's a lot of trauma centers set up. It's a little bit premature. No one's been brought in terms of major numbers. So I was kind of like, wow, that's really kind of weird. Okay, well, you know, what do I know? I'm sure there's a trauma center set up all over the place, but being so close to the Trade Center, I thought for sure there's going to be casualties, you know, and victims that are in critical care, minor care, etc. And on the way back to the radio station, this was pretty telling how it's ingrained in my mind, because I started walking back and there were cars parked and doors open, trunks open, and radios blaring. all dispensing information about the events that were unfolding and what had happened so far. That was a pivotal moment for me as well, because I'm like, wow, these are New Yorkers, masses bonding together, every color, every creed, you name it, united together to try to find out what to do, where to go. What really was happening? Should we make a run for it? Is there more coming? At this point, they knew, obviously, it was intentional. I can't remember exactly the timing in terms of if the both towers had crashed by then, but I think they did. Pulverized. That is etched in my mind. So I remember going to a nearby pharmacy and said, hey, listen, can I use your phone? Because cell phones were out. And he said, yeah. So I called the radio station and did a couple of live reports right there on the street, because it's something that people needed to know. What information in terms of hospitals, what they could do, what they were, the officials and medical facilities were telling people to hang on. They did not need blood at that moment. But more importantly, the vibe and the emotion on the street, it was palpable. It was huge. It was like nothing I've ever experienced, and hopefully nothing I will ever experience. So it's called Patriot Day, 9/11, 14th anniversary. Hard to believe. All different things happen. This weekend will be actually the 27th of September, Tunnel to Tower Run. Pretty powerful and poignant event. A lot of officials, fire, EMS, police take part, civilians big time. My sister has run it for 2 years in a row, and she said, Mark, you got to run this with me. I said, absolutely. Think about this for the children who were infants at the time. They're teenagers now who don't know their mother or father or grandparent or parents' best friend, whatever their relationship may be. And it's always nice to see that the reading of the victims' names are still, tradition still continues. I think that's very important, because it gives everybody a way to never forget, and also to have a, excuse me, a personal hand in it, a voice. And I can't imagine how difficult and arduous it would be to get up in front of a podium and read 10 or 15 names and to be composed, knowing, you know, there are children up there now reading who don't remember their father or mother or person of their family member or brother or sister, possibly, if they were very young. So that's happening here tomorrow in New York City and nationally, Patriot Day. Wear your colors. So going back to how I kind of broached this with my son, I had to choose my words delicately, but it's great that this information is being dispensed to kids in the first grade and subsequently higher grades. And he was so kind of moved by the fact that I had a friend that no longer exists. And he knows, you know, my father is dead, my brother's dead, and things of that nature. We brought in the death talk, you know, not as a dark thing, but just as a fact of life. And of course, with children, it's everything is how you couch it. So that's what we did there. And the same thing with 9/11 Day, Patriot Day. But, you know, as children get older, you kind of peel back the onion a little bit more, because obviously you don't want to give them more information scary, or what's the word I'm looking for? Maybe too adult information prematurely, because, you know, that's not going to do any good. But hey, this is our soil. We're proud of living here. We're proud of being New Yorkers living in the tri-state area. We're proud of, you know, I'm sure everyone who's listening, wherever you are in the country and internationally, you know, no one wants this to happen. Terrorism still exists. I imagine it always will. I think we've done a great job keeping it at bay on American soil here. I think the biggest thing right now that we're dealing with that happens that it's much more difficult to put a cap on are these random shooting sprees that seem to be happening way, way too often. And that kind of dovetails into our next subject, mental health. Gun control, things of that nature are kind of hand in hand. As I mentioned to you before, it's National Suicide Prevention Week, and you're listening to PRN.FM. My name is Mark Farrell, host, and I'm happy to welcome a very, very seasoned doctor, very, very impressive credentials. Throughout her career, she has focused on training healthcare leaders, physicians, and patient groups to change the healthcare system. This is huge. Change their approach to mental health, fighting stigma, and optimizing care for those suffering from mental health conditions. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, known as AFSP, which I'll be referring to them a lot because that's a mouthful. It's been around for many, many years, and I'll introduce how I've been related to them and other family members of mine. But I'm happy to welcome to the show Dr. Christine Motier, Chief Medical Officer. Hey, Christine, how are you? She's not on the phone right now, so we're going to get her momentarily. The reason why I became introduced with AFSP was when my brother took his life in 1992. Yep. So my brother committed suicide, and we didn't know what to do. We didn't know where to turn. Yeah, it was a drastic, drastic event. So within 2 or 3 weeks, I don't know how we found out about this, but we went to a meeting not too far from the house where we lived, my mother and I and my middle sister, Mary. And it was an offshoot of the AFSP. And that really was such a major, major relief outlet, a source of hope, which was gigantic. I was able to actually go and sit into a room 2 weeks after my brother jumped off the building and listen to other people tell their story and share. I probably didn't do this the first or second or third time, but share some thoughts I had that were just totally freaking me out. I did not know what to do. So there was a safe place. I was so very, very relieved. Now, granted, there was a lot of work to do ahead, a ton of work. But the fact that there was a platform in existence for me to go to, and basically the groups were like this. Everyone met in one room. It didn't matter of your age, gender, etc., who you lost. And then there's a few conversations going on, some dialogue. Then you broke out into groups. So I broke out into a sibling group. So all the people that I was in a room with, excuse me, had lost a sibling, brother or sister. And some people lost more than one, which totally blew my mind. I mean, to have a sibling take their life is just, I can't even put words to it. And have two siblings take their life in your family? Wow. Sometimes I just couldn't imagine what my face would be like and my jaw was on the floor. So that's how I was introduced to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. It definitely made a huge difference in my life. For my mother, for anyone losing a child, the order is not natural. So for my mother, this has been an outlet for her to heal and to help others. She became the chair over many years, the chair of the New Jersey chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. My sister is quite involved. She's a board member. They're both passionate, very passionate, dedicated. We all do what we can. I've been voicing the commercials for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. They have walks that are raise money, national walks too, every year. I've been voicing those commercials, and that means the world to me because I've been taking part in these walks, and we'll talk about those soon once we get the doctor on the phone. But it's paramount for an organization of this caliber to exist because they help so many people. They raise critical funds that can be used for research, and that's important. So we're going to still get the doctor on the phone, and we're going to return after this break. And this is PRN.FM. This is Insight.
Thank you for listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
The Progressive Radio News Hour is an antidote to government and corporate propaganda. Distinguished guests are featured. Some are world figures. All are independent thinkers. Truth and full disclosure are featured. Vital domestic and world issues mattering most are discussed. Today is the most perilous time in world history. Ukraine's crisis escalated things dangerously. It's the gravest one since World War II. A potential clash of civilizations looms. More than ever, vital information is needed. It's our most precious commodity. How we use it matters most. Peace and security depend on it. The Progressive Radio News Hour, three times weekly, live on Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, plus two pre-recorded archive programs. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
Have you ever listened to Anthony Robbins, watched the movie called The Secret, or read about the power of positive thinking from the perspective of any of the many fine authors who have written about the subject? They all focus on the law of attraction, which governs every second of every life of every person in the universe. Like attracts like, and everything you do, feel, and think about as a regular way of being determines your life experiences. PRN's new show, LOA Today, explores all aspects of this magnificent law of the universe every Thursday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. Join hosts Walt Thiessen and Ioana June Thiessen as we explore the law of attraction each week. That's LOA Today, Thursday evenings from 7 to 8 p.m. here on PRN.
Join the movement at PRN.FM. Your best source for progressive programming.
Fog Hat. Incredible stuff. Slow Ride. Turn It Up. I had to play this for you because your insane host, Mark Farrell, teaches spin at 5:30 in the morning. And I played this morning. And I said to myself, you know what, I got to start the show off like this. Well, we didn't start the show off with it, but you still get the feel of it, right? What a great way to start the day, exercise. And it dovetails also into our next topic, mental health, because if you feel good physically, hopefully your body will follow suit. You got to take care of that temple, right? Well, we did a really nice intro for the doctor before, but unfortunately with technical difficulties, we weren't able to get her on the phone, but she's live with us right now. I'd like to welcome Dr. Christine Motier, Chief Medical Officer to the show. How are you doing, Dr. Motier?
Doing great. Thanks so much for having me on and for highlighting mental health today.
Absolutely. Of course, we're going to get into the week and the specific day. And but first, I want to ask you, because I think this is so fascinating, in this year, 2015, is it still accurate to say that there's so much of the human brain that we do not know about?
You know, I would say the physical aspects of the brain we actually know a lot about. We know how different parts of the brain, what they're for, how they communicate with each other, synaptic pathways. What we are, I think, in the transition phase or playing catch up with is how that relates to the big picture of human behavior and also some clinical mental health problems that people have in terms of like depression, anxiety disorders, addiction. Those are the parts that we're still doing the link up between the brain and kind of the manifestation in terms of human behavior.
But the chemical imbalance, that really hasn't changed in terms of the knowledge in the last 10 or so years, right? I mean, you've known about like SSRI and things of that nature.
Absolutely. Yep. We've known that mood has a clear, pathway that people can have mood changes and have mood be destabilized, right? And that clearly does relate to serotonin and dopamine, those kinds of chemicals in the brain that help the neurons to communicate with each other and actually with other parts of the body as well.
What's the actual difference between serotonin and dopamine?
Well, dopamine has some very specific functions in mm-hmm. the brain, and it relates to a person's ability to feel pleasure. You know, if you think about every moment in the day when you just get that, you know, that sense of either connection, purpose in the world, joy or pleasure, and the normal state in an average person's day, we have all kinds of those moments of feeling pleasure. That's related to dopamine being in your brain and those parts of your brain actually functioning properly. And of course, just like any other organ in the body, things in the brain, functioning in the brain, can go wrong for a variety of reasons. And so serotonin is a little more, does some kind of more global things, like your sleep patterns, your general sense of well-being or distress, mm-hmm. sense of hopelessness. So they overlap a little bit as well in terms of mood.
So when I just got like a feeling of like a rush and like a tingling sensation, not when I heard your voice, well, you have a very nice voice as well, but when I played the Fog Hat Slow Ride song, was that, obviously it's kind of euphoria, but can that be tracked to or responsible because of dopamine?
Absolutely. And here's a very concrete example of what, how dopamine is involved. When somebody takes a street drug like cocaine, a stimulant, what happens is that street drug actually makes a lot of the neurons in the brain, and particularly in those pleasure reward centers in the brain, kind of just release all the dopamine that's there ready to go at the end of the nerve ending. And so that rush that you feel, which again, an average person can feel in a small way.
Sure.
Quite a lot during the day, and that's part of the normal human experience, is those little excited feelings as well as sad or down or frustrated feelings. That's all within the normal range. But what happens then, in the example of addiction in particular, is that after somebody has gone, let's say, on a drug use binge, they have depleted the dopamine in their neurons, in their brain, for a period until their brain can make more, and that's usually a period of about 3 days, a few days. And so anyone who's experienced addiction, has had that kind of experience with a binge, they know that there's a flat period where there is no pleasure, and and there's a lot of craving that's happening during that period of time of kind of withdrawal. And so those are very physical things happening in the brain.
I can attest to most of that because in my former life, I did a lot of cocaine. And there's nothing on the table in front of me right now except notes and things of that nature. But but it's true, though. I mean, the elation and the euphoria that you felt when I would do that first line or so was, you know, very gratifying. And obviously you would kind of different from other drugs in terms of crack. And we're going to get off our point here in a second. But I understand what you're saying and how it relates to the brain and how it makes you feel. Now, as the conversation progresses here, I want to make sure that our listeners understand some semantics that I became familiar with about a year or so ago that is more the modern movement. Correct me if I'm wrong. Died by suicide is much more preferred nowadays versus committed suicide or things of that nature.
That is absolutely correct. We know now that based on research, and you like exactly the questions you're asking about, how does the brain work? Do we understand aspects of it? What we've learned is a lot of things about suicide, and that it's not just related to a stressor that a person experiences in their life, and suddenly they sort of lose their mind and make this decision. It really does have its suicide has its roots in a complex interaction, but mental health is one of the key contributors. And so once we understand, and we do now, that suicide has a major link to health, to mental health, then we know that this isn't a criminal act. It's not something to be viewed as cowardly, selfish, or weak. It relates to a moment where that person's brain is not functioning well at all. And they make a decision, but it's a decision not based in their usual way of making decisions. So the term committed really does come from a time when it was a crime, actually, all around the world, including in our country. And, you know, committed a criminal act. Well, suicide should not have that language associated with it, because this is a major public health problem that we're now working to reduce and to prevent that loss of life.
So the semantics I never realized the history behind it, and the etymology, certainly, when you put those words together, but it makes complete sense. And certainly the organization of your caliber, AFSP, where you're trying to do many things, education is a huge variable in terms of your initiatives. So I'm happy to see that, because a person of, for example, I was telling my story here when we were trying to get you back on the phone. In 1992, I lost my brother. And of course, you know, I'm sure I used all the wrong semantics, et cetera. Never knew about how to cope with loss, et cetera, especially when suicide is involved. So, and I imagine, and you as a clinician as well, you must be in many, many circles where people use the wrong terminology, insensitivity. That's a whole nother, you know, topic and interview. But I guess that's why we have these conversations, and that's why we have weeks of this, because it's education. It's for people who don't know anything about mental health, who may, and we will get into this a little bit later, about what they possibly may experience in life, and also for the people who have lost people, family members, friends, et cetera, or multiple people, for them to be able to bereave, maybe feel happy about the person in a positive way, because things have changed, and I think we owe a lot of this to organizations such as AFSP and also social media.
Yes, that is exactly right. You know, many people are still using the sort of old-fashioned terminology because we are in a time of change where science led to discoveries, and that's now, just now, trickling out into changing attitudes and beliefs around our country. One example of a really nice change that happened, speaking of the term change, and is that the Associated Press, the AP Style Guide, actually put out a statement in their last version of the AP Style Guide that actually recommends against the use of the phrase committed suicide, and gives people the correct, just like you said, died by suicide or took their life, just saying it in plain language instead of that term committed. So that's a wonderful step in the right direction, where, again, you know, scientific discovery informs the way people understand issues like cancer. You know, there was a time that you may remember, if you're old enough, when the word cancer had a lot of shame and stigma, and people wouldn't really say it out loud in polite circles. And of course, now we know that it's a health issue that has nothing to do with a person's weakness or their personality. These are health issues that anyone deserves treatment for. And the same thing goes for mental health problems.
True. I think the big C word just has different connotations now. It's just if people imagine it as doomsday.
Right.
Versus
right.
The former meaning. Now, in the U.S., interesting stat here, 41,149 suicide deaths were reported in 2013. And that was the latest year that the data was available, I believe, from the CDC. 41,000. Almost 200 people, 41,000 in the United States. That's gargantuan.
Yes,
I mean that's a town.
That's right. It's again. I think we're in an interesting time where this is now awareness is being raised. Let's frame it that way. You know, if something were taking the lives of 113 Americans every day, linked to a preventable cause that we knew we could do something about, if that were a new fact, that would get the attention of the media in a big way. It would be a major loss, like any event where tragic loss of life does happen. And yet we've been living with this throughout history and largely not talking about it until, I'd say, recent years, recent decades, when people have absolutely come out of the shadows to not only talk about their loss of loved ones to suicide, which has been happening now, as you know, for probably 25, 30 years mm-hmm. in a very growing sort of movement. But now, a very interesting change has happened even more recently, which is people who've experienced suicidal thinking or their own attempt that they've survived personally are now joining the movement and coming out and speaking about those issues and advocating that they're human beings with rights. These are rooted in mental health problems, not, you know, some something that should be cloaked in stigma and mystery like it had been previously. So I think this signifies a time just like in the HIV/AIDS movement and other health or even other social issue type movements like the gay rights movement, where once people start speaking out and speaking out for themselves, not just after the fact of loss of a loved one, but that there's something that can be done for me, a person sure. who has had their own struggles. And as we recognize that these are people among us in our workplace, celebrities who come out about these issues, will realize, and I think America is realizing, that these are health issues. They can happen to anyone. Genetics has something to do with it, environment, upbringing, but that's like any health issue. That's the same as heart disease. All those same factors, genetics and
Absolutely.
Environment and, you know, mm-hmm. lifestyle, that steers the way other medical conditions go as well.
And where we take one step forward, we take two steps back because the media, for example, I think it was 2 weeks ago, pick up the Daily News or the New York Post, I don't want to blame one erroneously,
sure.
shows
sure.
the picture of the path where someone leapt from a building, complete with arrows and everything, and that's just so uncalled for.
That's right. There's still a tendency for some. Many of mm-hmm. the major media outlets have actually become very informed because, as you know, there are now very strong media guidelines for safe and effective reporting on suicide because we don't want to contribute to contagion. And that is one aspect that we do need to be well aware of. But when we report on suicide, when we talk about it as a health issue, as a preventable cause of death that we actually should raise our awareness for ourselves, for our family members, that something can be done. If you detect that somebody is having changes in their mental health, there's no reason not to approach them just like you would if you noticed that something were changing in their physical health and offer to help them, offer to, you know, take them to the doctor or to the therapist. So those are the kinds of ways that if we talk about suicide with some facts and with some the truth that is hopeful attached to it, those are the safe ways to talk about suicide.
Dr. Christine Motier is my guest today. She's the Chief Medical Officer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. My name is Mark Fowler. The show is Insight on PRN.FM, talking about the person or family or individual that has never experienced anything mental health-wise. And take myself, for example. I remember one day walking across my apartment and got a full-body rush of, like, complete tingles. And I was like, what is this? And I imagine, I don't even think I asked anybody. It was my physiology changing. And things happen to different people at all times. I suffered from depression, anxiety, major extreme panic attacks where, you know, I had sweat on top of sweat on top of sweat, lost like 15, 20 pounds that I couldn't afford to lose, and things of that nature. And it's different for everybody. But the biggest thing that I was afraid of was telling somebody.
Right, right. And that silence keeps people suffering unnecessarily because you sort of get frozen, almost paralyzed, and feeling like I need to just hide it from the world. And then you spend more energy, keeping the secret of it and just
and then come
to
the
put
drugs
on
and
the
alcohol.
Strong, sure, right. Self-medicating mm-hmm. and substance use is super common. For people who are trying to address their issue, but not in a productive way. And so, I mean, I think the good news is, that it is a changing time, and we can feel empowered to be here's some information that might be important for people to know. It's not only that the science is growing and really informing us well, but the American public is becoming more informed. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention recently conducted a Harris poll with two partner organizations, the Anxiety and Depression Association of America and the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention. And together, we surveyed American adults across the country. And lo and behold, we're now living in a time when 9 out of 10 people say that they value their mental health on an equal playing field as physical health. And 93% say, if someone in my life were in distress and I thought that they were at risk of suicide, I would do something about it.
Fantastic.
So there really is a growing awareness. I think now we need to spread the word that that's actually the majority of people.
Sure.
You're not in the minority if you
Absolutely.
Know that and feel that way.
And that,
yeah.
And those opinions and results are going to be shared on your website, I believe, throughout the month?
Absolutely. And they've actually, that Harris poll has gotten quite a bit of attention in through major media as well. So I'm very encouraged that we're seeing the evidence of the ability for people to acknowledge that mental health and human behavior are not completely mysterious or not just attributable to somebody's bad choices or to their personality, but there is an organ in your body called the brain that contributes to all of that.
For some of us, they have that organ. But yes, also employers need to get on board, and insurance companies and policymakers, which I believe you spend a great deal of time on Capitol Hill, along with many of your colleagues, trying to convince lawmakers and policymakers about change and the major significance in our country.
Yes, that's absolutely right. AFSP has a very strong policy office and thousands of volunteer field advocates in all 50 states who are actually having an effect. Laws, for example, that encourage or mandate teachers to have some hours of suicide prevention education so that they have eyes on our youth.
Pivotal.
So that they know what to do if they see that. That's one example of the work that our policy office can do, and all of the volunteers. Another one is that parity for mental health conditions has been acted into law 7 years ago. Now we're at a time of figuring out how to actually implement and enforce that, so that insurance companies and employers are held to that level of accountability.
And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that your organization, AFSP, I'm sure, along with your assistance and guidance and professionalism, enacted the interactive screening program, evidence-based way to reach people most at risk and connect them with the support, information, and help they need. So how does this work? Is it, and has the date been proven accurate?
Yes.
Data,
so our interactive, yes, it absolutely has. The neat thing about our interactive screening program is that it's not just a screen that kind of just, you know, is on you to do something about, but the information then is linked to a counselor who will dialogue with the person anonymously. So for people, and that's all of us, who may have concerns about, especially when you're in distress, it's still a very natural response to feel like, who is safe to know and to talk to about this? So it can be the first step in the person figuring out, is this something that truly relates to my health that I need to do something about? And so it's been implemented in hundreds of universities and colleges around the country, and now increasingly in other organizations like workplaces. It's also linked up on the Veterans Administration Veterans Crisis Line on their website.
Love it.
And hundreds of thousands of veterans have been linked to help through our interactive screening program. It's called the self-check quiz on their website.
What a phenomenal
concept.
Yeah, phenomenal concept. And this is free.
It is. Now, the way it works for workplaces is that they can license the use of it, and so there is an annual fee. It's a very nominal fee. What our chapters like to do, we now have 78 chapters in almost all 50 states across the country, and our chapters are full of passionate people whose lives have personally been touched by suicide, again, either by loss or by their own personal experience. Or they may just be advocates. You know, they may be clinicians who are so passionate about the people they work with professionally that they serve as advocates as well. Well, part of what our chapters do is they not only raise funds and raise awareness, but then they give back to their local communities in a variety of ways through the educational programs that I mentioned, like for teachers, mm-hmm. But also through this interactive screening program for their local colleges or workplaces in their communities.
And when was this rolled out, Doctor?
Oh, gosh. The interactive screening program was developed about 10 years ago, but it's really been in the last, I'd say, 5 or 6 years that it's being implemented much more widely.
I want to talk about the what the FDA called for a black box warning. This is probably 5 or 7 years ago, warning on antidepressant medications. Now, I know there was a lot of pushback from a lot of different people. Some felt that basically for our listeners that need to have a clarification. If some people who were on medication, for example, my brother, he was on Prozac for 3-4 weeks, and apparently it was speculated that he wasn't at the therapeutic level, but it did give him enough energy, maybe enough hope, and this is all speculation, that mm-hmm. he was able to commit suicide, and that's what people were thinking, and so warning labels were created, etc. Now, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has a different stance.
Well, what many people mm-hmm. have looked at is that the actual data. So the data that drove the FDA to make that decision to place the black box warning was actually not related to an increase at all in suicides. There was no increase in completed suicides in the data set they were looking at for antidepressants. What it relates to is as you mentioned, this possibility that as somebody starts a new medication that's active in the brain, this is probably true for any psychoactive substance. For a person who already has obviously a condition that they're being treated for, probably something like serious depression or an anxiety disorder, there will be changes then in the brain. And over that period of transition, what we know is that in those early few weeks after somebody starts on a new antidepressant or after the dose has been changed, that can be a time of transition where some people will experience increased energy. Some will even experience things like increased agitation or anxious thoughts. And so for some people who may have already been suicidal at baseline, that can be an uncomfortable experience. Or, as you mentioned, symptoms can change at different rates. And so their energy may pick up, but their feeling of hopelessness and their suicidal thoughts may still be there. So it's a time that the warning was meant to have doctors and families be aware so that there would be additional monitoring and sort of supportive care that takes place in those early weeks. The end result that actually happened was that antidepressants were not prescribed nearly to the same extent, and actually far few people were even diagnosed with depression. So it became something that everybody took as a sort of, I think, became a little bit fearful mm-hmm. about, particularly
sure.
primary care doctors
and liability.
Yes. And what we saw, unfortunately, was a blip up in the wrong direction on a population level in terms of suicide attempts. So it may have actually had a negative effect in terms of impact on treating depression appropriately, monitoring as the black box warning was intended for. It clearly was not intended for people to back off on even treating a serious health condition.
So how did your organization basically counter that by saying, listen, you know, that we don't want this to go in the other direction? Obviously, you said there was a blip in the wrong direction. So was mm-hmm. it through education, through professionals, as my introduction included, in terms of one of your angles of where you're working?
Absolutely. What we try to do through all of our educational programs, our website, our media and communication strategies are to raise awareness about, again, from a very broad level, to understand that mental health conditions are common in our population. It's 1 in 4 people. And so these are not things to shy away from. We wouldn't do that for high blood pressure or for a broken leg. We would just simply want to have it addressed for ourselves or for our loved one. And so the same thing applies for mental health conditions. Now, we don't say how to do that, because that is between, you know, doctors and patients and therapists to figure out the best treatment plan. That may look different for different people with depression or with, you know, bipolar disorder.
And research has proven that men typically use more violent ways, guns, firearms, et cetera, women poisoning, and I'm generalizing here, and I'm leading into my next method here. By jumping, suicide by jumping. And that led the AFSP to, I guess, reach out to a lot of different pivotal areas in our nation, San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge, George Washington Bridge. And I know the Golden Gate Bridge is has agreed and, I believe, designing, constructing something that's not going to be done for many, many years, I believe, 2018 or 2020, but a safety net.
That's right. There are many studies, actually, of actually, any type of lethal means that's used for suicide. And when the method or the means is restricted, even if it's just to put a time delay, a pause, you hit the pause button so that the person does not have immediate access. You know, around the world, and particularly in Asian countries, the number one method for suicide is actually pesticide poisoning, because that's just a commonly accessible substance in those countries. And so in every case, whether it's bridge barriers, whether it's firearm safety policies that were implemented, whether it's blister packaging of potentially toxic medications, when those efforts are done, then the suicide rates decrease for that population. And people, I think this goes to a common myth about suicide, which many people think, well, if a person is bent on suicide, you know, you hear that phrase, then there's no stopping them because they will find a way. And the reality is, what the science tells us is that the moment of suicidal crisis is very time limited. It lasts a period of minutes to hours, and so if you keep those lethal means separated from that acutely suicidal person, you will potentially save their life. And many people who have survived suicide attempts go on to live beyond that, and will say that their health was restored after that point. They found hope. They found a pathway through it. And so restricting lethal means is actually a very effective way at reducing suicide for a population.
When bridges are known by their body count, there's definitely a time and need to do something, that's for sure. And a GW bridge, I believe, had signs, and I believe your organization, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, was responsible for this, that I'm not exactly sure what they say, but maybe there's a help number, a 800 number, crisis number?
Yes. What we've seen is that by pairing prevention strategies, so you give the person another option, but the physical barrier actually turns out to be important as well.
Sure.
It's probably not enough just to have the suicide prevention lifeline number there, although that's always a positive thing to have that available.
Even when you're stuck in traffic on the GW Bridge, at least you have something to read.
right.
Oh, I'm sorry, doctor. I thought you were going to continue. So, yes, no, those coupled together obviously can do a great deal of good. I mean, if you save a handful of lives, it's well worth it.
Well, right, and it can turn out to be more than a handful when we're talking about a population in our country losing 41,000 people a year. So if we were able to limit access to particular lethal means in a way that is effective, we would be able to save lives. It has been shown, even for building a barrier on a bridge where, let's say, there are 50 deaths per year, that the majority of those people do not find the nearby bridge to jump, actually. It's that impulse actually has a peak and then comes back down, so that they find a way through it. So it's it's beyond even just a few lives. It could be a major effort. Now we direct our efforts not just to, you know, bridge barriers and those lethal means issues. We really do everything from, as I mentioned, educating teachers, first responders, parents, as well as clinicians, primary care physicians, and staff who work in emergency departments.
Sure, sure.
We're really at a time where there still are some false beliefs out there about suicide, and many healthcare professionals don't realize themselves that suicide is preventable.
Doctor, we're running out of time. I just want to get to one more quick point here.
Oh, sure.
And I could talk to you for another hour or two easily. do you feel that it's the duty of couples, parents with no mental health history on either side, to due diligence, to understand what mental health is, to recognize signs in their children as obviously they become teens, et cetera, because you want to be armed with enough information in anything in this world rather sooner than later?
I certainly do. And I think, again, the reality is that these mental health problems are along a continuum, a spectrum of severity. So oftentimes families don't realize that they have actually had family members, whether it's aunts, uncles, people that they may not even have realized, that were struggling with a mental health condition. They just never had it addressed and it was never out, so to speak, in the family. And I think, you know, for parents who have lost children to suicide, that's exactly what they say. They say, I wish I had known that these are the things that I could have been teaching my child and equipping my child, and why wasn't that being done in the schools, and why wasn't that part of the pediatrician's visit? And so that is absolutely something that we all can be doing, whether it's for our children, for ourselves, our spouse, or our coworkers. We all have a role to play in preventing suicide.
And we're going to have to leave there. Dr. Christine Motier, Chief Medical Officer of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And as quickly, we didn't get to, we mentioned at the beginning of the show, it's National Suicide Prevention Week. Over a bigger picture, today is the World Suicide Prevention Day, where people are wearing their apparel, et cetera. And I believe you can log on to AFSP.org, AFSP.org. There's things you can submit, pictures, et cetera, able to win a prize, things of that nature. Oodles of information for you to get involved with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, including community walks. There are national walks where thousands and thousands of people get together, which I've partaken, including the first one in Washington, D.C. It's an incredible movement. I urge you to be a part of it. It's a great way to earn and contribute money, not earn, contribute. Where's my mind in this? I'm not earning money. Contribute money to an incredible cause. Thank you for your time and the incredible organization's work that you've been doing so far.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you for the work you do, and really a pleasure to speak with you.
Best of luck to you. This has been Insight on PRN.FM. We had a lot of things to talk about this morning. Ran out of time very quickly. Nomophobia. I got that this morning. I woke up. I felt very odd. It's the fear of being without your mobile phone. Yeah, that's how I'm going to end this. I'm going down to the San Gennaro, Feast of San Gennaro Festival, get a sausage and pepper sandwich. My name is Mark Farrell. I'll catch you next Thursday on PRN.FM. Of course, this podcast, this show, and all other podcasts are available on our website. Just check out either host page or Insights, and have a great day. Bye-bye.